I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Oh, we're going to have a fascinating hour this hour. Two deep thinkers, Paul Ehrlich and Michael Tobias, spent several days together at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Colorado. They were hiking and they were discussing the fate of the world. They talked about all kinds of subjects. Should we be vegetarians? Of the many issues that confront us, how do we make decisions about which one is most important? What about the natural gas boom? How should we interpret the Second Amendment? Is consumerism in China more problematic than consumerism in the United States? Did Harry Truman do the right thing in using nuclear weapons? What can we do to solve these five huge global problems? Climate disruption, extinction, loss of ecosystem diversity, pollution, and human population growth and resource consumption. So I think we have a little bit to talk about this hour. Paul Ehrlich, very well known to you, Bing Professor of Population Studies and the President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. He is the author of many important and frequently cited books, including The Population Bomb, The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, and Humanity on a Tightrope, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. Also, Michael Charles Tobias is with us. He's an ecologist, an author, filmmaker, president of the Dancing Star Foundation, which is focused on international biodiversity conservation, global environmental education, and animal protection. He's the author of World War III, Population and the Biosphere at the End of the Millennium, and Sanctuary, Global Oases of Innocence. Paul Ehrlich, thank you very much for being with us.
Great pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you here. And Michael Charles Tobias, thank you so much for being with us.
Indeed, a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, there's so much to talk about, gentlemen. It's a fascinating, fascinating conversation. Let's start with vegetarianism, if you don't mind, because it's a subject that you two, one of you is a vegetarian, one isn't. You know, it's something we do every day. We eat, and I'm wondering how important a political decision it is to eat, and also what it is we choose to eat. Michael, let's start with you, because you do not eat meat.
Well, I'm a vegan. I have been vegetarian / vegan most of my life on ethical grounds, and I would add to that scientific grounds, because I believe that the climate disruption, the depletion of natural resources, water abstraction, injection of methane into the upper atmosphere, which is a very aggressive greenhouse gas, of course, but the suffering of the individuals themselves, and we're talking in the trillions if you include fish, trillions of animals each year that are slaughtered under Holocaust-like conditions, is just something I could not bear from my early years on. And it's only grown in terms of my grasp of the full complexities and convolutions of our species dominating all other species.
Paul Ehrlich, what do you say?
I think he's largely right. Unhappily, a lot of us find it difficult to change our eating habits. We form them very young. But, for instance, Ann and I no longer eat red meat very often, and if I can do it, I'm going to quit it entirely. I agree with Michael on the ecological consequences of our eating much too much meat. We differ a little on, how important it is not to eat chicken. Because
right.
Chickens are one of the most successful organisms on the planet, largely due to us. And I'm a person who recognizes the fact that I can't always do the things that I think are most ethical. I think most of us run into this all the time in our lives. And it's like the decision whether or not to fly to Europe to a meeting on global climate change,
right,
for example.
Mm-hmm.
Should we do it? So this is one of the cases where I'm largely on Michael's side in terms of intellect and ethically, and different from him in what I actually do. That's something I think most of us have to learn to live with in one context or another.
Well, we'll get back to chickens later on in the show, but let's look at, and you discussed this when you were in the mountains, all these issues. There are so many issues. There's energy. There's population. There's what we eat. There's just one after another after another. You debate the question of all the issues. How do you choose what you're going to spend your lifetime on, what you're going to work on as a human being, just personally what you're going to do? We can be overwhelmed by all of it. So how do we sift through it, and should we concentrate on one or the other? Paul?
Well, I concentrated early on looking at all of them at once and the connections. In other words, I think one of the biggest problems in our society is that people don't make the connections. You get article after article in the newspaper, say, about climate disruption. I mean, after all, in parts of the Midwest were flooded a few days ago.
Yes.
Just yesterday, the East was flooded. Nobody mentions that population size is a critical issue in how much the climate is ruined. Because the more people you have, the more greenhouse gases go into the atmosphere. Detroit had a big problem with its water. Nobody mentioned that if we weren't vastly overpopulated in the United States, if we had a sensible-sized population, say 100 million in the U.S., we wouldn't have to be dumping so much fertilizer on the fields that they run into Lake Erie. Lake Erie wouldn't be warming so much because we wouldn't have so many people making more and more greenhouse gases. The infrastructure for water purification could be much better because we haven't been keeping our infrastructure up with our runaway population growth. And so I decided early on that the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford would focus on the connections. We may not be able to go as far into depth on a single issue as many organizations can, many researchers can, but we can look at all the connections. And I think, in a sense, Michael has the same sort of approach. And so even though we occasionally disagree on things, we're really tied together at the hip in terms of our basic ideas and how we want to approach the problem.
Michael.
Well, I think what we tried to do in our book, Hope on Earth, a conversation, it really is a question mark that's just not seen in print, so to speak. It's in the conversation itself. And it really does hinge upon how we prioritize amidst an absolute welter of imperatives. Everyone has his and her own problem and worry and anxiety and pain. And how we connect the dots is definitely, I think, the pressing issue of the 21st century. It's been said that King Lear by Shakespeare is too sublime to be translated onto the theater because it's just something that we need to keep rereading and rereading. And it's the same with the ecological crises of the 21st century, which are unprecedented in the annals of biology. We need to understand that the fuel of so much of that misery is indeed human demographics, that a planet of 7.2 billion people that's already outstripping by at least 3 to 4, some have said 5 times, the resources available on planet Earth, needs to reexamine its principles, as some of the great historians like the late Arnold Toynbee reminded us when he soberingly narrated the 22 extinctions we know of within civilization, 22 different human societies that have gone extinct before us. They did so as a rule because they overstepped the carrying capacity of their environment. So where I'm coming from principally, like Paul, is trying to connect mm-hmm. the many imperatives. And for me, the underlying reality is that people can make a difference if they will take the steps to alleviate suffering, whatever that means. A grandparent with Alzheimer's, a rescue puppy in need of love. It can take so many different incarnations, but we're all capable of helping others. And I think that's number one.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend more time on population because, Paul, your book has been so much cited and such an important book in the 20th century. What's happened since 1968? Are we worse off or have we taken your message to heart?
Well, let's put it this way. We have seen a cheering but gradual decline in number of births and total fertility rate, particularly in the rich countries. And that is heading us towards a possible peak population in the vicinity of 10 billion people at the end of this century. Unhappily, as was just pointed out, we're already far beyond what the planet can support sustainably. We're having, you know, people say, well, how are we going to feed an extra 2.5 billion people by 2050. How indeed when we're not feeding roughly 3 billion today? In other words, people say, oh, well, Ehrlich predicted famines, but nothing's happened. Everything's been fine, the Green Revolution. Well, if you look at the numbers, something on the order of 900 million people are starving today. Another at least 2 billion are micronutrient malnourished. And we're planning, in quotes, to add another 2.5 billion people between now and 2050. That is, we're going to add more, many, many more people to the planet in the next 40 years, roughly, than were present on the planet when I was born in 1932. And the idea that all this is going to be easy and that we don't have to worry about it, there's already 2 to 3 billion people worrying about it because they're not decently fed today, because they can't function properly, because they don't have enough food, because they're more likely to die and their kids to die because of hunger. Look around the world today. There are mobs of people trying to move from Africa into Europe, from Mexico into the United States and so on, because the rich countries have cornered the resources of the planet, and now they're trying to keep the poor people out. What's going to happen when there's more than twice as many people in Nigeria as there are today? And that's what the situation is going to be in 2050. We have extraordinarily serious problems, almost all of which are at least partially connected to the number of people we have, which everywhere is many too many. And the idea that the growth rate is going down is fine, but it should be going down much faster. We should be giving women rights all around the world. Every sexually active human being should have access to modern contraception and to backup abortion. Anybody who fights against having backup, safe backup abortion available is simply pushing very hard to kill women. Hundreds of millions of women have died over the last decade because of bad abortion laws promoted, unfortunately, by very unethical people.
Hmm. Let's look at the rate of consumption in the world. There are more people. Those people want some of the things that we've had here that have made our lives pretty darned easy. Have we leveled off with consumption, or are places like China and other countries that are beginning to experience wealth consuming a whole lot?
Oh, our consumption rates are escalating rapidly, and the disparities between consumerism are glaring. For example, the average U.S. consumer emits approximately 20 tons per carbon annually versus an annual average of 4 tons. And what we're seeing in places like Africa, a continent which is poised to double in population, is a youth bulge where something like 75 to 80% of the population in the coming decade will be in sexually active years, young people who will also, by the way, be devouring the majority of livestock that will be raised in the world. That livestock will be, again, depleting fresh water resources and also compacting the soils, which will in turn deter agriculture. The consumption aspirations, which are promulgated everywhere on social networks, on television, in theaters, and so forth, have only gone toward the old cliche, everyone wants to be like their neighbor in Beverly Hills, so to speak. You see it in China, where the box office now is a dominant factor in the calculations in Hollywood. Same in Bollywood, which has now had its latest film celebration in Florida, not in India, because they're looking to the American market. It is a jigsaw, but there's no question that with population increase, consumerism increases as well. Dr. Ehrlich and his colleague Dr. Holdren, who's now a White House Science and Technology Advisor, chief advisor, I believe, came up with the I equals PAT equation years ago. Paul can address that, and because I don't think the variables have changed. They've only escalated in the scope of intensity with which this planet is consuming and eating up the world.
Paul, expand on that.
Well, the equation simply is very straightforward and easy to understand. The impact that we have, any society has on its life support systems, is a product of three different things. Population, that's the P, how many people you have. A, per capita consumption or affluence, that is how much each person consumes. And T, a factor that counts in what kind of technologies you use and what social arrangements you make to use them. So that, for example, the impact of a person driving a SUV is enormously higher than somebody who walks to work. And so the three things multiply together. You cannot separate consumption from population size when you're looking at the impacts. The cheery thing there is that we know that if the incentives are right, you can change consumption patterns extremely quickly. We learned that during the Second World War when countries completely changed their entire economies and consumption patterns in response to the growing war. Unhappily, though, to humanely reduce the population size, which is badly needed, is going to take a very long time. And so one of the places that we should have started that long ago, and we should be starting right now to deal with the consumption patterns. If you are somebody who worries about immigrants wanting to come to the United States, then have the United States stop looting the world of its resources. We have a military establishment that is primarily designed to keep the flows of oil coming to the U.S. I mean, you remember the old line, how did our oil get under their sand? Why is there such a huge mess in the Middle East? Because the rich countries, starting after the Second World War, tried to divide up the Middle East to make sure that we could keep getting the oil we wanted. And we're still at it, fighting resource wars over there. We're bombing again in Iraq. I mean, give me a break. When do people start looking at this and understand, for example, that trying to get the oil from the Middle East is like trying to get their cyanide if we're hungry? We can't afford to burn the oil. We shouldn't be killing people over it.
And what kind of consumption is most damaging to our environment, to our world?
Well,
heating and energy.
In terms of energy specific,
That's what Paul said. Would you say it's heating and energy, Mike?
No, eating and energy.
I'm sorry.
I would agree with that. I mean, the first place that human beings really confront nature is on their food plate and then what they wear. So the breakfast, lunch, and dinner table is really like the historic campfire of about 800,000 years ago. It's where human beings theoretically come together, share some campfire stories, so to speak, and then rush off to work or to school or whatever else they're going to do. But that is where we encounter the natural world more than in any other domain, sadly. Statistics have indicated that kids graduate from high school having spent a grand total on average worldwide of maybe 10 minutes out in the wilderness. They can rattle off hundreds of labels and the latest, you know, downloads and rock bands and fancy tennis shoes, but they virtually know not a single species in the natural world. So this ecological illiteracy stems from the fact that when they sit down to have their breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they really don't have a clue what they're eating. And they really don't have a clue, most of us, where that food's coming from, how it's produced, and the energy inputs that got that food onto our table, let alone the fact that a vast majority of that food, 95% of that which is consumed by our species, has a face. Mm. And that really upsets me personally. I take it very personally.
I know you do. And Paul, let's talk about energy for a moment. Now we have this huge natural gas push. We have earthquakes taking place in Oklahoma and other parts of the country that may indeed be related, although people are saying it's not related if you're in that industry, to what we're doing to the rocks and everything to get at this newest source of gasoline. It's kind of goofy that we haven't done the studies before we started doing all the work.
Well, it's more than goofy. Naomi Oreskes, who's a great historian now at Harvard, who wrote the book on how the fossil fuel industry has been hiring liars to fool people about climate disruption. She just wrote a column, which I thought summarized it very nicely, just saying that it's not a bridge to the future, the natural gas boom. It's a bridge to hell. In other words, there's not the slightest chance that we're going to do anything except keep burning that stuff. It is not probably quite as damaging as coal as a source of fuel, but it may be very close because of the amount of methane is a much more active in the near-term greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. It's one more attempt to avoid changing business as usual. And every scientist who's looked at it, the scientific community has repeatedly warned humanity we're going to have big changes, and one of them has to be really stopping burning so much fossil fuel, and that includes wrecking the country and blowing up half the country, polluting our water, and so on to get natural gas. Very, very major mistake. It's the classic mistake is if you've ruined something by doing the same thing, just keep doing the same thing.
Well, I think we're going to get more than a few phone calls for both of you gentlemen. Paul Ehrlich is with us, Bing Professor of Population Studies, President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. Michael Charles Tobias, an ecologist, an author, filmmaker, and president of the Dancing Star Foundation, focused on international biodiversity conservation, are our guests. The two gentlemen, wouldn't you have loved to have been with them as they conducted these wide-ranging conversations? Well, you get second best, because you have a book that's about their wide-ranging conversations when they spent several days together recently in Colorado hiking and talking about the fate of the planet. The book is Hope on Earth, A Conversation, and we are welcoming phone calls. We have other areas to move into, but I think they've already given you enough so that you have some response. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. You can always leave messages for us, and this may prompt some interesting ones on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to let you know about a special event coming up here in southeastern Wisconsin this coming Thursday, September 25. It's not this coming, but it's going to be here soon. I will be at the Elm Grove Women's Club with a lot of people from Wisconsin Public Radio, and we hope to meet you there. I'm going to be sharing some stories from my 39 years of working in radio here in Milwaukee. It's been a long, long time. So you can listen to that, but you can listen to each other because it's always a good group of people. We'll have some door prizes, packs of books that we have talked about on this show. We may include the one. Let's include the one we have today. Yeah, we will do that. So you have until September 11 to register, September 11, and you can find out all the details at WPR.org/Milwaukee. It's WPR.org/Milwaukee. We are so pleased to have Paul Ehrlich and Michael Charles Tobias with us this hour to talk about the fate of the Earth. Their book is Hope on Earth, A Conversation. And let's start our calls with Jess in Milwaukee, who's been waiting quite some time. Hi, Jess.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I enjoy this topic, but the problem with this topic is that every time it's discussed, nobody ever brings up the God issue. And what I mean by that is in the first couple of passages of the Bible, it says specifically, be fruitful and multiply. If God wants us to be populous, then he will provide for our needs. The problem is when man's greed comes into picture, and one of your guests hit on some of this, they take a commodity such as water, or I should say a natural resource called water, and they make it a commodity. Therefore, it's ours, it's not yours, when it should belong to everybody. And the problem is the greed factor. It's not simply consumption. It's the greed and the profit factor that come into it. When you look at global warming, what also is not into play or brought into subject is the fact of the holes in the ozone layer and how did they get there? They want to use carbon emissions and aerosol cans and so on. How about nuclear explosions in the atmosphere while we were testing during the 60s and the 50s? This had nothing to do with it, I suppose. And the atmosphere, the ozone layer, is what protects us from the sun's direct rays.
Paul Ehrlich, let's give this one to you.
Well, greed is, after all, the basis of Western civilization, so I have to agree with the gentleman very largely. Interestingly, though, on the Bible issue, my daughter, who has a very close friend, who's actually a poor campesina from Honduras, we're having a discussion, and the campesina, who's deeply Catholic, said that she was upset because her sister was having a third baby. And my daughter said, well, doesn't the Bible say that you should be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth? And the woman replied, ya conquistado, it's subdued already. And I think that's a message that really ought to go out to the people who think that some sort of supernatural monster is going to save us and supply us.
Thanks, Jess, for the call. Gary in Duluth, hi.
Afternoon. I'm thinking there's a real connection between the patriarchal cultures and the socialization process that goes into making patriarchal cultures. What I learned in the psych and sociology was that most men learn that aggressive behavior is masculine. And my sense is we have people that are aggressive, people that are passive. We don't have enough people that learn how to be assertive.
Mike.
Well, I think this gentleman is correct, and I wouldn't categorize aggression as gender driven one way or the other. We've seen plenty from both genders and third genders, and even if you go with some of the native indigenous traditions around the world, third and fourth genders. But the point is, aggression is aggression. And I think what we really need to see advocated demonstrably in our school system, starting from K to K-12 and then onward, is nonviolence. We've spent tens of thousands of years exploring violence and techniques of violence and meeting out violence, particularly to those who are voiceless, who have no constituencies, who have no way to fight back. And I think it's time that our civilization wakes up, becomes adults, and teaches nonviolence. And I'm really happy to see that there are institutes for compassion and teaching of nonviolence that are springing up around the world, starting with the Institute for Humane Education in Maine, that now has a program that actually gives certificates for those who have gone through these trainings. And I think it's really essential. It's a counterpart to the ecological violence we've been discussing on the show, that people realize that they have to take responsibility for their children and educate them about compassion and about nonviolence.
This might not be related, but it's an interesting story, so what the heck. I think it was you, Paul Ehrlich, who write in the book about your visit to Jane Goodall, and you tell this story about an ape. I don't know if it's pertinent to this conversation, but I wonder why you tell it, why it's in the book, and maybe it is pertinent to what we're talking about now.
That is of deep concern to biologists is the issue of where violence comes from and what you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually know the answer. In other words, when you have a big brain social animal, and we are highly social, human beings live in general in much bigger groups than any other primates. After all, although we were a small group animal for most of our history, those small groups were still around 150 people very often, much larger than, say, the average other primate. And so we're capable, very much capable of doing violence. We're also very much capable of reconciliation, of being friendly, of being helpful, mm-hmm. of being cooperative more than any other ape. The human beings are cooperative breeders. For example, human females will give their offspring to other females to nurse. No chimpanzee would ever do that. No chimpanzee ever lets its kid out of its sight, basically, because another female or another male may very well kill and eat it. So we are very cooperative. We can be very loving. When violence comes along, it's because of circumstances. Shortage of food. For example, the violence that I described in Jane Goodall's colony of chimps is a violence that arose in a situation where what originally the chimps had 60 miles between the lakeshore and the end of their habitat where farmers had moved in. By the time by the time I got there, there was only 2 miles left. A very unusual situation. So, yes, human beings can be violent, but we also know that human beings can be taught, can culturally evolve nonviolence. And that's the critical thing. And I agree with everything that Michael said. We praise violence in our society. We have militarized our police force now. Look at what's going on near St. Louis, where once again, unarmed citizens have been shot by police, and we're generating a situation of violence, partly because of the racism in our society. Since we've decided to live in groups of billions instead of tens and 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 150s, we've got to get rid of racism and sexism. It's absolutely essential for our survival of our civilization. We can do it, but it takes political will and leadership. And, of course, all you got to do is look at Washington and see there's no political will and there's no leadership.
Let's go to Frank in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hello. Thanks My question is simple. It's do you think that humans are basically a part of the natural world anymore? At one point, it seems like they were. Nowadays, not so much. Thanks.
Michael.
Yes, it's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because eco-philosophers, students of every persuasion, all of us, I suspect, at one point or another, are bound to think about that. And yes, of course, we're part of nature. The question is, to what extent have we, in our fantasies, determined that we are nature's supreme purpose? Because there's a lot of people who are either faith-based or other-based in some domain who think that we're the end of it all. We're the reason for it all. And I think that's what has led to this domineering species we call Homo sapiens. We're not superior. In fact, try to fly. Try to swim upstream like an anadromous salmon in Alaska. Try to do anything that most of the animal world and the plant world can do. And, of course, we soon realize that we are basically condemned to utilizing our brains to survive. And there's been about 110,000 years of conceptual evolution going on in the human species, but no physical evolution. So we're really in a kind of cerebral cul-de-sac. It's a dark night of the soul, and it's really coming back to haunt us now with a fury. So I, to answer your question, the short of it is, of course, we're part of nature. The second part is the implication. What are the responsibilities of that, given what we have so aptly documented in terms of our past as we look toward the future?
And thank you very much for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Let's go back to the issue, and we're seeing evidence of it every day. You mentioned the flooding that has taken place, these weather patterns that are getting stalled, and these huge floods. And they were in, what, Detroit and the East Coast yesterday. We've had them in Milwaukee. They've just been incredible. And as I was listening to the news last night, I was hearing weather forecasters saying, well, this is because of what scientists are calling weather patterns that are getting stalled over areas. And of course, other scientists and most scientists will say that it's due to climate disruption and to the warming of the planet, et cetera. Those stories are so upsetting that you would think that we would be taking whatever kind of action we can right now, because they're starting to affect so many people. What do we do about that? Because it seems like it is becoming more and more urgent. Paul Ehrlich?
Well, it is becoming more and more urgent, because what we're seeing, you can't say that any given flood was caused by global warming. What we are seeing is changes of the entire weather system, which we understand partially but not fully. For example, as you know, when you warm the planet, when you warm the atmosphere in general, it holds more moisture, and guess what? When that means you have bigger rainstorms, and you change the patterns of circulation. One of the really frightening things has been the diminishing of ice in the Arctic, and people say, what the hell do we care? We'll be able to mine where we couldn't mine before, and so on. Well, unfortunately, the entire planet's weather system, the climate system, depends in part on how much ice there is in the Arctic, because that partly determines how cool or hot the entire planet is. When you melt the ice by making it warmer, what happens? Less of the sun's energy is reflected away, because the ice reflects away energy. Seawater absorbs more energy. So when you reduce the ice, you absorb more energy, which makes it hotter, which further reduces the ice. So you absorb more energy, which makes it hotter. We're beginning to see, most climate scientists think, changes in the overall circulation, the stalling of these fronts. That has produced the record drought in California, record rainfall in parts of the east, and so on, may very well be partly connected to the diminishing of the heat gradient between the equator and the pole, in part due to melting of Arctic ice and the overall greater warming of the Arctic than elsewhere. We're screwing around with a system that was in a very stable state for about the last 10,000 years. We developed agriculture at a time when the climate was as beneficial as it could be. What we're doing now is shoving very hard to move the climate out of that stable state that has been so beneficial for humanity. And we're seeing increasing signs of more extreme events and so on that indicate that the models are probably correct, and that we're going to move the climate into a brand new state. Why should we care about that? Because, of course, the amount of food we're able to grow is absolutely and totally dependent on having a stable climate. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're getting rid of. So we're undermining the food system. But guess what? The food system itself produces about 35% of the greenhouse gases that are changing the climate. So the more we expand our food production, the more we're going to change the climate, and that's going to damage the food production. So it's a really scary system. Scientists are really scared. Go to mahb.stanford.edu and read the scientist's statement there. The scientific community has repeatedly tried to warn humanity that we're going in the wrong direction and that it's extremely dangerous and that population and consumption are major factors in it, and yet nobody pays any attention. In 1993, there were two huge statements from the scientific community, didn't get carried by the mainstream media at all. The fact that the scientific community thinks we're going down the drain isn't news. The latest, the November IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, did not get as much coverage on NBC News as the retirement of a Dodger baseball pitcher. I mean, give me a break.
Michael, do you have hopes that we're going to be able to take on and solve this huge global problem of climate disruption?
Well, I think the bigger question, it's a superb question, of course, and it's the burning question, literally, but I think the bigger one is, will it take us on? You know, in 1877, estimates are as many as 3.5 trillion Rocky Mountain locusts devastated much of the central portions of this country, and we're headed towards the east, that the extinction of the passenger pigeon in 1914, which John James Audubon thought would never go extinct, that the very name, the Anthropocene, which scientific communities around the world now agree we are in, which is the sixth extinction spasm in some 4 billion years, that these cumulative events are occurring at an accelerated pace. And given the degree of disparities economically, given the political apathy that is still at large in so many regions and nations, given the fact that more than 50% of the world's nations are still gaining in population, not diminishing, and more than 50% of the world's population live in non-democratic political situations, one could be very dire about it all, for sure, which questions the very notion of our title, Hope on Earth. Is there hope on Earth, right, which you've asked? And my answer is mixed. I really believe, as Paul said earlier, that human beings are capable of unique cooperative mechanisms, which we see every day. There's a degree of nurturance that's enshrined and encoded in our genome and in our behavioral traits. And the best possible prospect that I can enunciate is the fact that we are not condemned or liberated by evolution. Evolution does not condemn or liberate us. Only our choices can do that. So that said, everyone makes choices every day. Everyone can be empowered. Everyone can become involved, can volunteer, can educate themselves, recognizing the peril that this planet is in. And so if you take the bulwark of 7.2, 9.5, 10 billion ungainly, largely carnivorous Homo sapiens, I still would hold out that a force of 10 billion individuals who finally got the message across can take action and can make a difference. Are they going to save millions of species from extinction? Probably not. Unfortunately, I don't think there's time for that to happen. Are they going to save tens of millions of species from going extinct? Possibly. We still have time. I mean, and every individual counts.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. The authors of Hope on Earth are with us this hour, Paul Ehrlich and Michael Charles Tobias. The book is based on days that they spent together recently hiking in the mountains of Colorado, talking about the really big issues of our times, really, and the fate of the earth. And they're worth listening to because of who they are. So here's our phone number, 800-486-8000. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul Ehrlich, Michael Charles Tobias, authors of Hope on Earth, A Conversation, are our guests this hour. And we go next to Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Hi. Oh, yeah. Thank you to the authors for their work. And I think that, you know, as a species, or even as a country, we're good at reacting maybe to a catastrophe, but this requires a new thing, I think, is to see the potential disaster and try to prevent it. And it seems like there's so much, like I recently saw a video from our library called Frack Nation, which dispels all the bad things about fracking, and another book that deals with it, it's called The Real Cost of Fracking, which is, you know, scientific proof of the hazards of this thing. It also includes massive destruction of wildlife and removing of hills in our state of Wisconsin for the fracking industry. And just the whole idea that somehow our political leaders, like our Senator Ron Johnson, doesn't believe in climate change. My local representative, Mr. Tom Larson, doesn't believe in climate change. So I feel like all this talk about God in this country, I think the thing we really worship more than anything is money and profit, and we're willing to sacrifice everything.
Yeah. Let's talk about this lack of leadership on this issue. It is true that scientists have been warning for a long time. Is it because scientists are too specialized and they're not speaking as a whole to take on this issue? Is it because there are too many lobbyists from the energy industry who are buying members of Congress? Where are the voices and the people who can really take action that is necessary? Paul Ehrlich?
Well, the latter is the case. There's too much money on the other side. The scientific community has spoken out on climate disruption more unanimously than it ever has on anything else. The idea that thousands of scientists are in a conspiracy to get more money. First of all, I wish I knew where the hell the money was, because I'm game to be bought, but nobody's come around. But huge amounts of money, the Western Fools Association, the various thoughtless tanks that were set up by the right wing in Washington over the years, they put huge effort in. You put anything on the web that says anything about the problems with climate disruption, and there's a whole mob of people who will immediately reply and say you're a warmist and you're an idiot and so on and so forth. And the scientific community, the IPCC, for example, has gotten out extremely detailed reports saying what the evidence is, saying what the uncertainties are. You never prove anything in science and so on. And it's just not done any good. We have shown without a shadow of a doubt that telling the American public what science is does not normally change their behavior. There still are, believe it or not, people in this country who can dress themselves who are creationists. There still are people who think that you can add CO2 ad lib to the atmosphere and not pay any consequences for it. And until you get leadership, I mean, we've had some from the Obama administration. Their science advisor, John Holdren, has spoken out repeatedly on the climate change situation, as has the president. Doesn't get covered in the media. Again, when you have a fully paid propaganda network called False News, where they're forbidden to say that the climate is changing, and that, by the way, is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who caused the what we call the Murdoch summer in Australia, where the country almost cooked and it's going to again. He controls what can be said on his networks. We have allowed private industry to buy the means of communication in our society. We have a Supreme Court that actually thinks industries and corporations are people. Remember, corporations can't have empathy. Corporations can't care. All they want is profits, and that's what they're going to do. And now that more and more industry is controlling what you can learn, what you can hear, we hope that the social media and civil society can overcome it. But I don't see any sign of it.
Well,
sorry.
That's all right.
Didn't mean to rant.
with that.
No, it's all right. Yeah. It's all right. Let's go to Ann in Platteville. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for being able to speak to these two august people, and you, of course, too, Catherine. This is a comment that I'd like you, your experts to remark upon. My observation has been that this generation is the first one to never really be uncomfortable or discomforted. I was lucky enough to have a father who was a bit older than many fathers, and so he lived through, went off to school in the midst of the Depression. And my mother was a child in the Depression. I never knew that kind of difficulty. I don't think as many of the people who go out to vote or who have can make choices about driving certain kinds of vehicles or raising their voice to their politicians to make these kind of changes aren't going to, because they would end up being uncomfortable, and that doesn't compute with them. They don't want to be uncomfortable. So I would like
some comments on that. Thanks.
Responses.
Thank you, Ann. Michael.
Well, listen, I think there's I think it's true, but only in the United States and only in specific areas of the United States. There's 40 million poor people in this country. And in my opinion, if you look worldwide, you're going to find that about 80% of the population is stressed out. So we're talking about 5.6 to 6 billion people who are not comfortable. And that is a reality that has been isolated. But I'd like to just make one really, I think, important point. Wisconsin has a really remarkable native son in the name of Edward Curtis, who was born on a farm near Whitewater, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, in late 1860, just after the Civil War, around 1868. He was a person who had nothing. He grew up son of a religious family. I think his father was a preacher. He had a love of nature, and he had a love of people. And he went on, of course, at a time when Native Americans in this country were being exterminated by policy. He went on to capture over 44,000 portraits of those people that were empathetic, that preserved and encouraged a renaissance, which we're seeing to this day now amongst indigenous peoples across the First Nations in the United States, and aborigines and indigenous tribal groups throughout the world. One would never have imagined that possible from the vantage of the days when Curtis was born. And I cite it as an example of a person who was uncomfortable, who was poor, but who was inspired to make a difference. And what a difference he made. So I think every individual has the power of Edward Curtis and people like John Muir, who would persuade Teddy Roosevelt to create the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for park preservation, for green corridors, people from every walk of life. But I cite Edward Curtis particularly because of Wisconsin, before he moved to Minnesota, of course. But there is a person who made a profound difference, and every one of us has that in ourselves.
Thanks very much for the call. Last call, probably. We're getting low on time. Rick in Ohio. Hi, Rick.
Hi. A couple quick things. First of all, Soylent Green mentioned global warming, so it's been known for quite a while. I forget whether that was 30 or 40 years ago. But secondly, you were talking about 10 billion people trying to feed them by at the end of the century. My concern is that with the warming, there will be no snow cap on the mountains, and so there'll be almost no water in many of the rivers. Los Angeles Water Authority is building some humongous tunnels and going to be building humongous reservoirs to hold enough water so that they can hopefully pump enough water during the rainy season to maybe 3 months to supply Los Angeles for the whole year, not just from the Rockies.
Let's get a response. We have about 30 seconds. Paul Ehrlich.
Well, that's a very reasonable concern, because much of our agriculture around the world depends on the storage of water in ice caps so that it can be used later in the year when ag is going. Let me say something cheery to end. I'm a
Please.
Child of the Depression.
All right.
And I remember how people got together at the beginning of the Second World War and changed all their behavior. We had, I can remember as a kid collecting milkweed pods to put in to make into life preservers. Everybody changed their lives because there was a need for society to get together and stop a real horror. And we got a real horror coming towards us. We can do it again, but it's going to take everybody's participation.
Thank you both, and thanks for the book. It's great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Ehrlich, Michael Charles Tobias. The book is Hope on Earth, A Conversation. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. We're with you again on Monday at 1 for all things political.